Very good. We'll talk about grazing management effects on the productivity of forage livestock systems. And it's kind of interesting how these symposia come together. The most important thing about symposia is to get on the planning committee, which I didn't do. And so what they've given me for a task this morning is to talk about all the effects of grazing management on the productivity of forage livestock systems. And then they mentioned to me, by the way, can you talk about all the terminology that we need to have for this these presentations this morning as well? So I'm going to try to give a whirlwind 30-minute overview of both of those topics. And I will say this, in going through all the literature of grazing experiments that have been conducted over the last several years, we are lousy at terminology. We have a lot of different terms in the literature that mean the same thing, and we have a lot of the same terms that mean different things depending on which papers you read. And it really becomes pretty confusing. And so bad terminology has led to, I think, a number of misunderstandings between scientists, but if certainly not between scientists, then between scientists and the people who use the information that we have out in an applied way. Most recently, Vivian Allen and a group of international authors have put together a very nice publication on terminologies to be used in grazing lands and grazing animals. It's free if you want to get it. I put the link here at the bottom of this slide. I'll just say that I'm not going to go through that in its entirety, but it would be a good read for all of us. And I've spent a lot of time over the past a month or so looking through that, and I've learned a lot myself just reading through how different terms are defined and how I've used them incorrectly in the past. And I think most of us in here will find that there are times when we've probably used some of the terminology incorrectly in the past. And so I'll leave it at that. Other than, I want to talk about some of the terms that are most often confused or communicated poorly. And probably the one that comes to mind most often that I see in both the scientific literature as well as popular literature is this idea of stocking methods versus grazing systems. They are very different kinds of concepts, and yet those terms are often applied to the same thing. And it's not unusual for me in Missouri to have a producer to come up to me and say, you know, I've put in a new grazing system on my farm. What the person often means is that they have gone from continuous to rotational stocking on their farm, and they've put in some fence and added some water. Yes, they've probably changed the grazing system, but that is not really, the stocking method does not necessarily define in its entirety what a grazing system is, or stocking method is just one part of that. Grazing systems include a whole lot of things beyond stocking methods, including the plants we're using, the animals we're using. Even social and economic features are important parts of defining what a grazing system is. And very often, grazing systems are site-specific sorts of enterprises. Now, stocking methods are different. And I want to just talk a little bit about some of the different stocking methods, what they are and what they are not. And so probably we'll just start off with the very simplest of those, and this was a review for a lot of us, but I think it's important that we define what we're talking about. Continuous and or set stocking, which are slightly different in definition but very close, is simply a situation where we're turning livestock onto a unit of land for some period of time and that the animals are allowed complete access to that parcel of land during the grazing period. Pretty simple in how that one is managed. And yet, when you look in the literature, you see things like this, continuous grazing. Okay, the animals are not continuously grazing that bit. That's the reason we like continuous stocking. They're stocked there all the time. They're not grazing every minute that they're there. Okay, and another term, fixed stocking. Okay, that's another term that's not preferred, but one you'll see in the literature some. The one that I like best is unmanaged grazing. Okay, this is not necessarily unmanaged. It may be the right management for certain periods of time. It may be the exact wrong management at other periods of time, but it is not unmanaged. Okay, rotational stocking. Okay, you can see in the graphic that I put together, this happens to be the same sized pasture that you saw in the first one that I showed. This one has just been broken into 16 subdivisions, typically called paddocks. Okay, and the idea would be that animals would graze for a short period of time, or would be stocked for a short period of time in one of these paddocks, and then would be rotated or moved to a new paddock at different times throughout the course here. And these paddocks may be grazed once or maybe multiple times during the course of the year. Now, it's often been called rotational grazing, as you might expect. We don't like that term because they don't graze for in that way, particularly when you compare it to continuous stocking. Sometimes called controlled grazing, as opposed to all the other methods being uncontrolled. Okay, intensive rotational grazing, that's a lot like rotational grazing, only it's intense. Like, I don't know, we give a cup of coffee to everybody here, and they're all intense about what's going on. Okay, or high-intensity grazing is another one that's used. All right, management-intensive grazing is another term that's been applied, all really meaning, in most cases, rotational stocking. There are some different philosophies and connotations that are applied to some of these terms, but this is generally what they mean. Now, one that you'll see that is in the popular literature a lot, and is part of the impetus, I think, for this symposia, is the idea of mob and or mob grazing, or mob stocking that we typically call it. And mob stocking is pretty similar to what we've done for years with strip stocking, where we're having, but the concept behind it is that the pasture is broken into a very small area, okay, where animals are confined at a very high stocking density, with the idea behind it that we will allow, we're going to force animals to utilize all of the forage that has been provided to them in a way that's almost non-selective by the animal, all right? Over time, these animals are moved either with or without a back fence, depending on the objectives, throughout the course of a pasture, maybe used multiple times within a year, or maybe used only every year or every other year, depending on the objectives of the producer. Okay. Now, this one has got, particularly when we read about mob grazing, as it's typically called in popular literature, there is a lot of unsubstantiated claims that I find in the literature, and we'll talk about those just a little bit. But in terms of names, you'll see it called mob grazing. High density grazing is another one that applies to this term. Ultra high density, that's a lot like high density, only more. Then you got super ultra high density. Now that's a lot. I don't know what it is, but I'm no joking. That is the one that I saw the other day, super ultra high density, it's a lot. The point is that they're all referring to that same method of mob stocking, and it's been used quite a bit actually over the years. We just haven't had it so popularized as until recently. A couple other stocking methods that I want to just define real quickly before we move on would be something called first and last stocking. And in first and last stocking is where we're using a method where we have two different groups of animals that are part of the grazing system, okay? And in one of the groups of animals has a much higher nutrient requirement than does the other group. For instance, you may find that in a cow-calf operation that the growing calves, would have a higher nutrient requirement than with their dams. Another example of it is where they've done some work in dairy cattle, where you would have high-producing dairy cows and lower-producing dairy cows. Okay, and the idea would be is that you would give the animals with the highest nutrient requirement first access to a portion of the pasture, okay, and allow those animals to take out the very best of the forage in terms of selection, and then allow the last grazers to sort of clean up the scraps, if you will. Okay, now this one. So conceptually, you would have the first grazers come here and then the last grazers, as I kind of have demonstrated there. And you could have this even with multiple groups. You could have 3, 4, 5 of these groups. You could have first, second, and third, and last grazers if you wanted to. It's also called leader-follower grazing sometimes. One of the reasons that is not a preferred term is it kind of limits you to two groups. And so this first and last stocking method is, or terminology is considered preferred. The last one I'll talk about is creep stocking. Creep stocking kind of follows a few of the same concepts. that you would have in first and last stocking, where you have a group of animals that have a higher nutrient requirement than does another group. And in the case of creep stocking, typically we're working, well, that wouldn't have to be, typically working though in cow-calf operations where you have calves that are still typically suckling their mothers, but they are allowed creep or access to pastures prior to allowing their dams to have access to the same pasture. And so what is often done is something with a creep gate or maybe the way the fence is structured, the calves are allowed to have access to a pasture for a while, but then they are allowed to come back to suckle from their mothers, and then they might move around this entire area of the pasture over a period of time. It can be a fairly effective, actually, way of managing a grazing system, okay? Also called creep grazing. So, other terms, and I'm not going to go through all of these that are often confused or communicated poorly with, besides stocking methods and grazing systems, would be forage quality versus nutritive value. And I've made this same mistake, all right? But very often we call things that are forage quality that are really nutritive value. Nutritive value is really a measurement of the fiber and the protein and the other nutrients in the feed, whereas forage quality implies something in terms of animal production. And then there are a number of things in that last bullet from grazing experiments that I wish we did a better job of both reporting in our experiments as well as defining well in terms of forage mass, canopy height, forage allowance, grazing pressure, and one I'll introduce you a little bit more to today in grazing pressure index. Okay, so we can talk about some of those as well. Common grazing management decisions. There are, as Craig pointed out, zillions of grazing management decisions that producers are asked to think about and have to make on an annual basis. Lots and lots of decisions and lots of different options. Two overriding factors when you look through the literature, and I'm sure most of you know this, would be stocking rate, but I'll talk a little bit more in terms of grazing pressure index, a huge overriding factor in the productivity of a forage livestock system, okay? And some specific topics within that we'll discuss, as well as we'll talk about stocking methods. Now, there are a number of other factors beyond these that can influence the productivity of forage livestock system. These are the two we're going to focus on today and look at what does the literature tell us about each of these major topics. And a pretty classic thing to find is something like this when we're talking about the influence of stocking rate on plant and animal productivity. This happens to measure animal productivity. This work is several years old, but it was done in California in the early 1960s. Looking at stocking rate in steers per hectare on the x-axis and up the y-axis on the far side of the room, and that's to my, I have this kind of mental block with right and left, but it's on that side where average daily gain is, in kilos per head per day, and then gain per unit area or gain per hectare coming up this vertical axis nearest to me. All right, and gain per hectare would be in the red squares, and average daily gain is sort of the black diamonds, if you will. Classically, what we see is that as we increase stocking rate, we see a decline in average daily gain. Typically, it's linear, and I'll talk about that in just a moment and what that means and doesn't mean. And we'll see gain per unit area, which again is the red squares, increase until some point that it's maximized, and you'll see a decrease when the stocking rate becomes too heavy. Okay. Now, two things that this tells me. If you look at average daily gain here, where is average daily gain maximized from that graph? It's at a stocking rate of zero, which doesn't make any sense. All right. And some of the limitations of the literature are that we don't often get enough data points to really define what these response surfaces look like. I realize these are expensive experiments, but obviously it's nonsense for us to say that the stocking rate of zero gives us the highest average daily gain, and yet that's where it's headed. Okay. What's nice about this particular bit of data is that at least there are enough data points to figure out where we have maximize the gain per hectare. There are a number of experiments that if you go looking through the literature, we've tried maybe one or two different stocking rates. And it's really difficult for me to do a regression to figure out where that would be maximized. Perhaps it's all for naught anyway, in that when I look at stocking rate across environments, as you might expect, it's not a very useful thing to know at how many steers or even how many pounds of livestock per unit area, or kilos of livestock per unit area, I suppose I should say, to get a maximum either average daily gain or in gain per hectare. Here are just six representative studies collected over the past several years. And what I've done with these in this table is I looked at different locations, and then in the next column over, I looked at the stocking rate at which average daily gain was at a maximum of the stocking rates that are tested. Now, most of these are linear, and so maximum average daily gain is probably zero in a lot of these cases, or it's at a zero stock. But this is of those that were tested, where did it come out? All right. And then looking at stocking rate, where maximum gain per hectare came out. You can see that in the third column over, the different species, and then the references here. Now, what you find, I think just at a very cursory look, is that depending on environment, the ideal stocking rate is exceedingly variable. Do everybody agree to that? For instance, in Wyoming, the maximum average daily gain was at a stocking rate of 0.2 steers per hectare, versus in a study in Florida, 7.5. Okay? Why is that? Well, these environments produce a lot. They have hugely different, that's a pretty bad term there. They're very different in terms of how much forage is produced per unit area. Okay? And so, I've been fooling around with a lot of numbers, and I'm sure that there are a number of authors who are either have had this sort of itching in the back of their mind that somebody has been messing with their published data, or perhaps some of it's old enough that there are a few people rolling in their grave at this point, where I've tried to calculate grazing pressure index and of studies that have been done in the past. Okay, now grazing pressure index is maybe a term that with which you're not familiar. It really tries to do this. It has forage consumption rate, and it's really an integral over time of forage consumption rate, divided by the initial forage mass, that's how much forage was there when grazing began, plus the integral of forage growth rate over time. Okay, so I made a little example down here. Let's say I have an example of 3 steers per hectare, each of them consuming 10 kilos per head for 110 days a time. Okay, and forage mass was 1,200 kilos per hectare at the start of the 110 days, and the forage growth rate was 38 kilos per hectare per day for the first 50 days and 20 kilos per hectare per day for the last 60 days of the test. All right, just a quick example. So if you do the math of that, grazing pressure index, it reduces down to a ratio here at the bottom of 0.76. Okay, now, if you got a grazing pressure index of 1, okay, it would say that, look, the animals ate exactly everything that we had available there. Okay, that's more or less what that said. At 0.76, it's a little bit less than that. Now, you're going to find that very few times, and at least certainly over a very long period of time, it's difficult to have that ratio anything less than 1. So then I calculated grazing pressure index at maximum gain per hectare from the same studies that I showed you earlier, from the different locations, and that is located. Is there a pointer? Excuse this here. Okay, thank you. In this column here. Now I wasn't able to calculate it from this particular study because everything was linear. And it's hard for me to get a fair average where gain per hectare would be maximized in that particular data set. But in the other data sets, I found that it seems to be reasonably consistent, that somewhere between about 0.68 and 0.8, or in that range, is where gain per hectare will be maximized at a grazing pressure index. Somewhere between 0.7 and 0.8 would be a kind of a generalized way of looking at that. The point of that is that grazing pressure index across environments does a much better job And there are other ways that we could do this in terms of forage allowance that might also be very good. But really would help us in the literature as we go forward as scientists to report these kinds of things so that we can look at it and say, you know, maybe this study in Louisiana is not really so different than the one that we conducted here in Minnesota. Or maybe it is. But it gives us an idea of how to look at that across environments. Okay. In terms of looking at grazing pressure and the nutritive value of forage, there are a number of things that we probably need to consider. Here's some work looking at forage allowance. Okay, and this is forage allowance in terms of percentage of forage allowance on a body weight basis of the animals, and looking at in vitro true digestibility up the vertical axis. Typically, as we increase forage allowance or decrease grazing pressure, you're going to find that the nutritive value of what's consumed as well as the nutritive value of what is left behind is greater than when forage allowances are more restricted. And there are a number of studies that would suggest that. Okay. Also, when we change grazing pressure, and we have some changes in both species as well as productivity of pastures. And here's some work out of Heather Karsten's lab. And what was done in this study was looking at grazing management in two different sorts of regimes, either a tall regime where animals were initially stocked in pastures at 27 centimeters in forage height and removed when forage was taken down to 7 centimeters, or in a short treatment where animals were initially stocked at 20 centimeters of height and allowed to graze the pasture until it was about 5 centimeters in height. Okay? Two things to point out. Total forage production was about, at grazing height, was about 2,000 kilos per hectare greater when forage was allowed to accumulate, or it was at the tall regime versus the short regime. But also you see a change in species. For instance, here's the species orchard grass. Okay, orchard grass is one that we know prefers not being grazed quite so short. And certainly that's what Heather was able to show here, that when they used a tall grazing regime, there was more orchard grass, was a bigger part of the pasture than when they used a short regime. Conversely, something like bluegrass, which is a species that I would say is reasonably grazing tolerant, okay, and also fairly a species that is not quite as tall as well, so it kind of fits into the short regime. You see, when we went to the shorter regime, it was a larger component than it was otherwise. Okay, so initial and residual forage mass do make a difference. And yet that's not always the same, as I mentioned a moment ago, not always the same for each species. And here's some work done in the late 1970s looking at the residual height in tall fescue. In tall fescue, when they went to a shorter height, grazing height, they were able to have more forage than when they used a taller grazing height. And so really understanding where we are with things in terms of grazing management is we have to understand something about plant parts and locating growing points. One of the things I think we could do a better job of is thinking about the physiology of the plants and the physiology of the animals and trying to match those things as part of a grazing scenario. And while there are a number of great physiological studies out there, and we have not always taken that information and applied it to grazing management in a way that makes sense. So, you know, you have species like tall fescue, which we consider to be grazing tolerant, but if you think about why they are, it's really because of the physiology of why they are the way they are. They tend to have growing points that are very near the soil surface. There are also species that tend to be somewhat decumbent. If there a lot of grazing pressure is applied, is another strategy that plants use for grazing tolerance. Frequency and intensity of stocking also matter in terms of how much forage is accumulated in pastures. And here's some work from Garcia just a few years back, looking at both severe and lax grazing or utilization intensity, and then how frequently that was done. So what was done in this work is this was actually grazed either every 7 days, which would be the blue columns, or every 14 days, which are the red columns, And then the severe utilization intensity was grazed with sheep down to about a 5-centimeter stubble, and then the lax down to about a 10 to 12 centimeter stubble, as I recall. Okay, when you look at forage accumulation, you would find that either going on a 14-day period, okay, and grazing it severely, or alternatively, not taking so much and doing it every 7 days, it provided about the same amount of forage accumulation. And so there's sort of this, always this age-old debate, you know, is it how much I'm taking off or is it how frequently I'm taking it off pasture? And the answer is yes. The answer is yes, it does matter. But in either case, when you look at it in terms of forage nutritive value, and this is neutral detergent fiber from the same study, using the same treatments, you'll find that that in the case of grazing it either severely, infrequently, or grazing it laxly, but frequently, provided neutral detergent fiber about the same level in either case. And so you can see that that's sort of the response surface here in either case is to either graze it severely and infrequently, or the infrequently and severely. There are a number of studies that have looked at roots in response to clipping and how frequently plants are clipped, forage plants are clipped, and how many roots that they're able to produce. I must say that there is not a lot in the literature, though, that has looked at this under grazing management. There are some studies, but a pretty limited data set that has looked at what is going on below ground in forage systems where grazing has been managed in different ways, whether it's done infrequently or laxly or those kinds of things. We certainly know, though, from greenhouse and clipping types of studies that the more frequently we cut most of the forage plants, the less root mass that we're able to come by. Okay, I'm going to make a little shift here to finish the talk this morning and looking at different grazing methodologies. Most of the literature you're going to find, at least scientific literature, comparing different grazing methodologies is going to be a comparison between continuous stocking versus rotational stocking. There are other reports of different grazing methods in the literature, but this would be the comparison that you can find most frequently. Okay, and I want to kind of look at it from about three or four different perspectives. We're going to look at it from a perspective of forage nutritive value or forage quality in some cases. I want to look at it from a perspective of how much forage is being produced or forage accumulation. And then we'll look at it from an animal output perspective. All right. Start off with looking at some of the work with nutritive value. And this is some recent work from Wisconsin looking at relative forage quality of animals in continuous stocking methodologies, rotational stocking, or not being stocked at all. So this is in the none case, is just a pasture that's been allowed to accumulate the entire year and forage samples taken with no other management applied. In this case, rotationally, animals that are rotationally stocked, or let me say the pastures that were rotationally stocked had a relative forage quality that was about 30 to 40 units greater than you'll find for continuous stocking. And when you look through most of the literature in terms of nutritive value of forage, you'll find that about two-thirds of the time there's not a tremendous, not a large difference in nutritive value between continuously stocked versus rotationally stocked. But where there is a difference, it's almost always favors rotationally stocked. Okay, a lot of the time it doesn't matter, but where it does matter, it's almost always in favor of rotational stocking when those comparisons have been made. Thank you. Let's take a look at rotational versus continuous stocking from a forage production or a, let's just call it a quantity measurement here, okay? Number of different studies that have looked at continuous versus rotational stocking in a lot of different types of comparisons, whether there was continuous versus an 11 paddock rotational stocking method or 18 or 2 or whatever the case might be. And I have to, even though I've acknowledged Lynn Sullenberg at the bottom of this slide, I have to say that I relied on this a lot, Lynn. Yeah, this is a good look at this. And what is presented here is different species of forage, different types of continuous versus rotational stocking methodologies in terms of the treatment. You can look there. And then these comparisons here, whether it was looking at average stocking rate or carrying capacity or accumulation rate. Those are all measurements of the quantity of forage that's available. And when you look at the advantage of rotational versus continuous stocking, while there is a huge range, ranging from about 9 to 68% increase, there's about on the average, about a 30 or 31% advantage for rotationally stocked pastures to produce more forage than those that are continuously stocked. Okay? Again, a wide range, depending on some of the managerial things that are used. I can understand why those constraints are the way they are, but a pretty large range there, but tends to favor rotational stocking. And so if we look at the stocking method, then impact on livestock output per animal. Okay, now livestock output per animal in most studies is measured as average daily gain if we're talking about growing animals, but could be done in other quantity measurements, or excuse me, I shouldn't say quantity, but other measurements of individual animal output, for instance, in milk production per animal in a dairy system. Okay. We'll use a number of these graphs here, looking at the number of studies in the literature. That goes up the vertical axis, and then I'll look at the stocking rate methodology used here across this bottom axis. All right, and so there's about 30 studies that were compared here where rotational versus continuous stocking were compared. And the two different stocking rate methodologies then are the same and variable. So let me just explain that. And where it says same, that means that the stocking rate for each of the two treatments was the same. That is, they both had whatever, 5 steers per hectare or whatever the comparison was. In those that are variable, some sort of variable stocking method was used, whether that was put and take, or perhaps in some cases where excess forage is removed as hay or silage, those would be variable types of stocking methods. Everybody with me? And then the comparison here are the different bar colors. The blue bars are where rotational is greater than continuous. Equal is the red bar, and then the green bars where continuous was greater than for rotational stocking. We all there? Okay. What you'll find is that when you look at output per animal, if we use the same stocking rate for both of those things, there's about as many studies that say the rotational is better than continuous as is vice versa, and most of these studies say there's no difference. When you look at a variable stocking methodology, about the same kind of result. Okay, output per unit animal is not really different for either of the two stocking methodologies. Now, when we look at output per hectare or output per unit area, for almost the same studies, there are some of these studies that I couldn't use in some of these comparisons. So I had 30 in the last one, there's just 27 here. And these are all from the humid United States or in areas where we were able to irrigate, or the researcher was able to irrigate. If you look at the number of studies here that says output per hectare, when we used the same stocking rate, we got about the same sort of answer. That is, that continuous versus rotational stocking was the same. But when we used a variable stocking rate, we get kind of a different result. We have about as many studies that say they're equal versus about as many that says there is some advantage for rotational versus continuous stocking. And the reason for that is what? As we said earlier, in rotational stocking, we're often able to grow more forage, but if we do not have some way of capturing that additional forage in the animal, typically by increasing the carrying, increasing the stocking rate, it often goes for naught. All right. The last ones that I'll finish up with will be for creep stocking. Not nearly as many comparisons to look for stocking methodologies beyond where they compared, say, continuous versus rotational, as you'll find for some of these other methods. There are many fewer here for creep stalking or the likes. Here's one that looks at creep stalking in two different types of forage bases, either brome grass red clover or tall fescue with nitrogen. I'll just say this much, that we looked at calf average daily gain, that the kind of forage that you have makes a huge difference in whether the stocking method makes any sense or not. And in this case, in a brome grass red clover pasture, there wasn't a tremendous difference, or was no difference, in calf average daily gain, whereas when in a tall fescue nitrogen system, creep grazing made some sense. First and last stocking. One of the kind of most unique studies that I think I came across was one that was done by Maine, looking at milk production, looking at in rotational stocking versus first and last stocking. And what the first and last animals were in this case was that the first grazers were high-producing dairy cows, and the last grazers were the herd where they split off the lower-producing dairy cows. And so, in one group, it was, you know, they were all mixed, and in the first and last stocking, high producers got first access to the paddock, and then the last grazers, cleaned up or had the second access to it. And they could show on an annual basis that using this stocking method produced about 200 kilos per head more milk on an annual basis than for rotational stocking. All right, so here are the conclusions that I get from looking through the literature. Okay? If you don't get grazing pressure right, which is, we realize that's influenced by stocking rate, but if you do not get grazing pressure right, nothing else really matters very much. You get that, you mess that up bad, so to speak, you can come up with whatever stocking method you want, and you're still going to get not what you expect, okay? Or you're going to get poor performance, all right? Stocking methods also are a factor. They're not as big a factor, in my mind, as is getting grazing pressure right. Okay, you got to get that right. But if you get that right, then rotationally stocked pastures, from what I conclude from the humid United States, is that it's about 30% more quantity than continuously stocked. All right? But you cannot count that as additional livestock output unless you are able to utilize that forage in some other way. That utilization may be increasing stocking rate at some time in the year, or maybe on an annual basis. It may mean that you're taking out excess forage as hay or silage and being able to market that in some way or utilize it at some other time of the year. But if you don't use it, it won't have a lot of advantage to you. Okay, there are a lot of limited comparisons of stocking methods other than continuous versus rotational. We got a lot of that in the literature. Sometimes not as much information as I would like to be able to calculate all the neat things that we probably need to be able to do, but there are a lot of comparisons of it. I would say targeted stocking methods are most likely to provide optimal output. And what I mean by targeted stocking methods would be where something like first and last stocking, where we really have thought about, okay, we've got good forage here, we've got animals that can utilize that, how do we get them access in a way that makes sense, and perhaps animals with lower nutrient requirements used forage in some other way. So those targeted stocking methods, and those targeted methods are going to change from farm to farm based on resources that they have. They're going to change based on the type of livestock operation that they are. And yet, we can still make some strong conclusions about which of those methods are likely to work in certain situations. Okay, and then I'll just say this. This is my last point. All stocking methods are governed by the same biological principles. Okay, I don't know how many reports I have to read in Gray's Magazine or whatever it is that have the new stocking method that's going to increase, you know, soil organic matter by 1% annually, or it's going to do this or that. They're all governed by the same biological principles, and it's really just up to us to grab a hold of those principles and find the right methodology for the right type of livestock operation. So that's where I am.